This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Well, December 24th has arrived. We've had some snow. We have some reason to hope that the next 7 days will be somewhat quieter and more reflective than the past 358. So it's time to turn off your phone and get your read on. Keith Taylor drops in sometimes to talk books with us. He's retired from the University of Michigan, where he taught creative writing to undergrads and graduates. He's the former director of the Bear River Writers Conference, and he's also our favorite secret Canadian. Keith Taylor, welcome back to Stateside. Right. Maybe not so secret. I don't know.
No, I'm a proud Canadian. I just happen to have lived in Michigan for 50 years.
Right. May I just say, first of all, I'm absolutely mortified. We just got so tangled up in the incredible mess that is 2020 hard news that I don't think you and I have spoken since last December. I'm really sorry about that.
It's all right, April. It's been a long time. I think I did a couple of short little essays in there early in the year, but it's partly my fault too. I just got all distracted.
And I think a lot of people are sort of feeling that this year, that they've gotten out of touch with people that they wanted to talk to. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
You know, I kind of didn't read the first 6 months of the year. Like, I was just kind of in a state of constant watchfulness, I think. And it was very frustrating. Yeah. I read some comic books, but I really kind of lost my books. And it wasn't till the second half of the year that I remembered, you got to bring some intention to this and get back to it.
Yeah, I kept reading, but I didn't do, it was very difficult for me to do book reviews. And I have, I have several options for doing those. And I just really flaked out for 4 or 5 months. But I just stopped. I just sat in my chair in the study and looked out the window and went on to the next book.
Well, there's worse ways to cope with the crazy that is.
It's true.
The craziness that is 2020. Can you, we know you brought some book recommendations for us. Can you recommend a story that maybe doesn't so much take us out of the craziness of the present moment as perhaps it might offer us a different lens on crazy?
So yeah, there was this very interesting popular history this year called The King of Confidence by Miles Harvey. What it is is the story of King Strang, the Mormon king of Beaver Island. I think a lot of us who live in Michigan have heard this story. There's a couple of historical markers up on Charlevoix or on Beaver Island. And we know about it. We know it's there, 30 miles off the coast of Charlevoix in the middle of Lake Michigan, this happened. And the story that kind of makes us smile, and that's often enough.
Well, I feel like the smile is probably going to fall off of people's faces when they get into this a bit. Can you explain who James Strang was and how he came to Beaver Island?
Absolutely. James Strang was, right at the time after Joseph Smith, the founder and first prophet of Mormonism, was assassinated by a mob in Illinois. Brigham Young had not quite taken over the Mormon church yet, although they'd begun the sort of slow movement out to Utah. James Jesse Strang, another Mormon not nearly as well-placed as Brigham Young, but perhaps a lot more of a con man, took another smaller group and brought them to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan, where very quickly he named, and they didn't pay for any of the land. They just took it. They took it from the native people. They took it from the few white settlers who'd first gotten there, and they took over the whole island in a matter of a year or so. He named himself King. He ran for the Michigan legislature, and since everybody on Beaver Island voted for him, he got it. He sent people out all over the upper Midwest and out to New York and things to recruit people to his group, his cult, and went on. They committed crimes. They stole horses. They were famous horse thieves. They protected each other. They would break each other out of jail if they were ever caught. They'd go to Ohio to break each other out of jail. So he was an interesting character, certainly charismatic, probably in his own way a kind of perverse genius, but crazy, absolutely crazy. I mean, he was just, imagined himself king of the world.
What kind of explanation does Miles Harvey offer readers about how somebody so unhinged kept such a tight hold on his followers?
Harvey makes the point that this is who we are. This we're talking mid-19th century here, before the Civil War, the rise of sort of capitalism, the rise of entrepreneurship. Americans just loved this sense that there was somebody out there going to take over and do things, and they were more than willing to follow him. Harvey has a real 19th century subtitle on his book. So it's called The King of Confidence, but the subtitle, which goes on a while, is A Tale of Utopian Dreamers, Frontier Schemers, True Believers, False Prophets, and the Murder of an American Monarch. That's all part of what Harvey talks about and what Strang was. Now, is there any explanation for the con man? You know, I don't know. Do we all look for someone in whom we can place our confidence? Maybe that's a human trait, not just an American trait, but you know, that seems to be there. Oh, if I can trust this person with my money, my liberty. In Strang's case, with my family and my wife and, you know, all of those things.
Keith, there's something on your list that feels like it might be a sort of a beach read, a novel by Natalie Bacopoulos called Scorpion Fish. Could you tell us about it?
Yeah, Scorpion Fish is interesting. It's Natalie Bacopoulos. She's a Michigan writer, but she's, you can tell by her name, that she's Greek. And she's fascinated by Greece. And this is, Scorpion Fish is a love story. It takes place in Greece, but you can tell from the title that it's probably a love story that has some sting in it that might be a little hard to hold on to. And that's certainly the case with this one. This is, it takes place in Greece. Bacopoulos' first novel also took place in Greece, although she teaches at Wayne State, so, you know, she's around, although I think she gets to Greece as much as she can, not this year.
Right.
When she can. The first novel took place during the junta, the lake called the Green Shore, during the late 60s, early 70s. This one takes place essentially now, after all that famous austerity program that the rest of Europe imposed on Greece and the refugees from the Near East filling the islands and filling Athens and changing the whole makeup of the place. She's got a character in here, a woman named Mira, who is returning to Greece after her parents, who had immigrated to the States, died. And that's interesting, too, before I get too far, that difference between immigration and refugee. That's a part of this novel, and it's hidden. She doesn't beat that drum too much, but that's an important part of this novel. What does that difference mean? What is the people who are in those positions, what does that mean for them, the difference between immigrant and refugee? Mira goes back to Athens. Her next-door neighbor in her apartment building is a man simply referred to as the captain. They talk on their porches. Now, if you've never been to Athens, every apartment has a porch, but the porches are all divided by walls. So you're out there with your neighbor, but you can't see him. You can talk around the wall, but you can't talk through it. And thus begins this very odd love story. It's told in two voices, Mira's voice and the captain's voice. And they go through all their, you know, their ambivalences. They, of course, you know, Greece is a small country. It's there's a lot. They have people in common, and they discover that, and they realize the importance of that. So they go through. They work out all these things. All these questions are circle around this subdued love story. What's going on in Europe? How do we deal with this historical moment? What does this austerity mean? How does it change us? So it's a very rich and textured love story, although the love story is still there and is still probably the through line, which is pretty interesting. And as you might expect, you know, every now and then she'll just stop and give some really gorgeous descriptions of Greece. And we like that.
Yeah, especially now when no one's going anywhere.
Exactly. Wouldn't it be nice to go to Greece now and see those islands? Yeah.
Keith, would it be asking for a spoiler to ask you if they ever end up actually seeing each other, if they sort of escape the geometry of their porches?
They do end up seeing each other. Yes, it's true. And they do a really beautiful novel. And the fact that she doesn't beat anything, even the love, that she doesn't sort of pound you over the head with any of that, is makes it a really provocative read, I think.
If you're just joining us, We're talking today with writer and educator Keith Taylor about some of his favorite books of 2020. I know you always have an interesting new book of poetry in your back pocket.
I do. This one's fun. Alison Swan did the first full-length collection. She's done some short collections, some chapbooks before, but this was in that Wayne State series. It's called A Fine Canopy. Alison, probably the largest reputation she's had in the state is as an environmentalist. She and her husband David won the Petoskey Award for Michigan Environmentalist of the Year back in 2002 for the work they did protecting the Saugatuck Dunes State Park. And, you know, I mean, that's all-consuming, thankless work. We are always under attack by highly paid people, you know, working for special interests. And they did all that, and they succeeded. You know, I think they succeeded. They worried that things are still never going to be right. But you know, they saved the place. Mm-hmm. But during all of that, she kept working as a poet. Really, really interesting poet. And, yeah, a nature poet or, you know, an eco-poet. Whatever you want to call it, although Alison Swan said a nice thing. She said, oh, eco-poetry, that's just the cool kid's name for nature poetry, which I thought was kind of good. I'm going to use that. There are poems in this book that talk about the dunes in Michigan, of course. She's got family history in the UP, so they go to the UP. She teaches at Western, but she lives in Ann Arbor, so there are poems about southeastern Michigan. So the poems go all, they're very much here. They're very thoughtful. She's got a long sequence of historical poems from the archives in 19th century voices. But I have one poem that I picked out from the middle of the book, April, if you'll let me read
Please
it.
Please do.
Which is very typical of what she does. This is called Outside. Snowplows pass on the road. She can feel them in her bones, like the vibration of the furnace. A ship's engine in the ship of her house, chugging through swells so far out to the sea, there are goddesses and nothing whatsoever to fear from the dark. So the house turns into the sea, and out there on the sea, we have nothing to fear. Just, I mean, and all that happening in less than 10 lines. So it is pretty. Yeah.
Keith, speaking of, you published your own new poetry chapbook titled Let Them Be Left, and it's about your time on Isle Royale. Could you say a few words about why you went out there? And then maybe we've got time to read a bit.
Oh, okay, great. In 2019, I was asked back to be a returning artist in residence. I've always gone to the wilderness because I've been inspired there. I don't think I'm particularly unique in that. Isle Royale is a particularly special place, and I'm not the only one who, I mean, I don't get all strange about sacred landscapes and things like that, April, but Isle Royale feels to me like a very sacred space. It's an interesting geology. The animals that are there are interesting and have interesting patterns, which are studied pretty significantly by wildlife biologists. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's surrounded by Lake Superior, the largest body of fresh water in the world. This was my second extended stay. This was the summer of 2019. And I had the same thing that happened to me almost 30 years earlier when I had the same appointment, that the work just came to me and everything seemed to want to make itself into a poem. Let me read you this little poem. It's one of the things I would see regularly when I was out on the point where the little cabin was, where they put me. It's called Scoville Point. There were shed moose antlers. There are a lot of moose on Isle Royale. Easiest place in Michigan to see moose, by the way. They're all over the place. And there were shed antlers. And I looked at those antlers, and they looked like bones. And usually when you find bones in the woods, you think, you know, it's an easy death reference, you know, the mortality and things. But when you look at antlers, they're shed because babies were made, you know. This was a mating ritual. And suddenly everything's different. So this poem came out of that. Moose antlers. Glisten like bone, hold the sun, the brightest objects on Scoville Point, nestled in a bowl of basalt and blueberries, bone shed after rituals of mating, 11 tines aside, the first polished and sharpened to stab and dominate, the bone-white palms rivered with lines of veins that once held the velvet, not a memory of death this time, but bone shed celebrating in bone brightness the spring-born calf, the generations of moose.
I don't think I'm ever going to look at antlers the same way again.
Good. That's always the
That's hope. Amazing. What's do you feel like you found some different things at Isle Royale this time than you did on the other trips?
Well, yeah, certainly, because I was in much, I mean, you know, I'm within spitting distance of 70 now. So, and I'm not, you know, I'm a guy who sits around and reads a lot of books, so I'm not in the best of shape. And I certainly felt it in the body. So I had to approach the whole thing more slowly, more cautiously. I had to watch where I walked. I used hiking sticks. It was a very different experience because of my body in that space. But still doable, a little more tiring. So every part of my encounter with Isle Royale in 2019 was slow and cautious. And that changed my attitude. It made me nervous. It didn't really frighten me, but it made me nervous the first few days. And then I kind of got into it. It was like, oh, okay. I can sit on this rock for 2 hours. I don't have to go anywhere. This rock is enough, you know? And that was really interesting. It makes me think if I go back when I'm 80, how I'm going to respond.
For sure. Well, Keith, is there anything that's on your mind as we go to close out the year? Other than the fact that I'm sure you share hopes that a lot of the rest of us have that we can just close the door on it and maybe move on to better things.
Yeah. Well, you know, people, I told someone else a couple of weeks ago, what do you miss the most? And oddly enough, April, I think I miss the most going to poetry readings. And I thought I was sick of poetry readings. I've been to thousands of them over the years. And I go to these things and I miss it. You sit with 5 or 15 other people, maybe 50 or 500 if it's somebody famous in some big auditorium. And you sit there and you listen to a poor, fragile human being say words that they've spent a long time thinking about. And you all sit there together, and sometimes it's silly, and sometimes it's stupid, and sometimes it's just deeply meaningful, and I just find that I miss it all.
Well, Keith, yeah. Please do take care, and let us know when something gets scheduled that you think we should know about.
Great, I will. Thank you, April.
Keith Taylor, writer, educator, and our very own literary buddy here on Stateside.